Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. Today we're going to primarily focus the show on answering your questions. We've got a lot of questions from listeners, and it kind of makes sense with all the chaos going on with PSLF and loan servicers and, you know, the Federal Reserve like slowing their bond purchase program, which could influence interest rates going up. So there's a whole lot of things going on. So I thought we would kind of go to those questions first. There's about seven listener questions today, which is a fair amount. And then we're going to go into the main topic of today's show, which is to talk about the latest on the student loan servicer moves that are going on, specifically Navient, FedLoan, and anything else we know about that to let you know what might be happening in that arena. First, we've got a question about tracking your non-PSLF student loan forgiveness.
Hi, Travis. I'd like to thank you for about 90% of the student loan information that I've learned over the last couple of years. It's been very helpful. Quick question on going for 20 to 25 year loan forgiveness. You often talk about how someone on PSLF should be documenting payments very well, kind of having a paper trail. Is something similar necessary with the longer term forgiveness? Thanks.
Makes a lot of sense, right? You've seen a lot of people have trouble with making sure that their PSLF credit is properly tracked. Wouldn't you need to do the same thing if you're going for a 20 or 25 year loan forgiveness program? What I would say is, as long as you're paying attention to something called your NSLDS data file, the answer is no, you don't need to worry about tracking this. The reason I say that is because your NSLDS data file is kind of like the master data sort of depository for everything you've ever done with your student loans. It's not always correct. When it's not correct, generally the reason is because the servicer coded something wrong and sent the wrong piece of information to the Federal Student Aid NSLDS database. That happens occasionally. Some of the situations where I've seen that happen, for example, with FedLoan, is FedLoan had this deal where if a consolidation loan is more than a certain amount, then they would kind of like split up the loans because for whatever reason, the person that programmed everything didn't comprehend that there could be a consolidation loan with more accrued interest than a certain amount. I think it was like $100,000. This might not be the exact example, by the way. I'm just giving you kind of like the gist of it. And so for a while, the NSLDS data files were showing like half of people's loans instead of all of it. So you'd log on to FedLoan and you'd see the whole thing, but then you'd log on to your studentaid.gov and you'd only see half of it. And that required calling FedLoan, getting the FSA office involved, and basically getting them to reconcile that data file. So as long as your NSLDS shows all the loans that you're supposed to have and it matches what your servicer has, what you then want to do is go in and look at if you are on an income-driven repayment plan. You can see this in your NSLDS. We have a tool that we give clients where we kind of do this for them to identify everything about their payment histories. It's part of our consult that we do. And so when we show somebody, hey, yes, you're on an income-driven plan, we can see in your NSLDS file that you've been on income-driven repayment for X numbers of years. Well, then it's as simple as just having that as your record. And as long as you've saved that off somewhere, maybe you save it off once every couple of years or something like that, I wouldn't worry more about it than that. You know, I think that what will eventually happen is once some people start getting their loans forgiven on a pay-as-you-earn or income-based repayment or repay type of plan, what's going to happen is I think they're going to create a form where you can track your progress towards the 25 and 20-year versions of student loan forgiveness. But they haven't done it yet. And the reason they haven't done it yet is because the first person that could potentially qualify for that, at least on a massive scale, is around 2031. So the reason for that is IBR got created in 2009. Pay-as-you-earn got created in around 2011 to 2013 kind of range. So 25 years after IBR in 2009 is 2034. Pay-as-you-earn would be somewhere between 2031 and 2033. Since it's more than 10 years away, Department of Education has just not gotten around to it, which I guess kind of makes sense. They've got other fish to fry, other things they're thinking about, like the immediate disaster that is public service loan forgiveness. So I think that you will eventually have a form that you can apply to and then correct any kind of discrepancies way ahead of time. Really good question. And now a question about qualifying previously ineligible payments.
Hey, Travis. Thanks for everything you do with the podcast and the course. They're fantastic. I have a question about appealing loan consolidations. I did a federal consolidation of my student loans in April of 2017 when I graduated from medical school. It was approved in August 2017, early August 2017, and about 2 weeks later in mid-August, the IDR application was approved as well. I believe I applied for both at the same time, the consolidation and the IDR plan. The first payment was scheduled in October 2017. I didn't think much of this at the time, but now that Fed Loan Servicing is getting out of the business and I'm getting closer to graduation, I realize that there are two payments that are missing. That is August 2017 and September 2017, after the consolidation was approved, but before RDR had kicked in, in which I have two ineligible payments now. I did contact Fed Loan Servicing and requested an appeal. They put me under the temporary expanded PSLF, which I don't understand why they did, but I got rejected. I'm wondering if there's another way I can ask them to review why I had these 2 months with ineligible payments and get them qualified. Thank you very much.
I'll tell you something that's not guaranteed to work, but I've heard people attempt it with some mixed success. If you, say, had a payment that was supposed to happen, but you didn't actually make a payment, what some people have requested from FedLoan is that they generate a bill for those 2 months. You know, who knows what happens with FedLoan getting out of the business completely, but while we still have them for the next month-ish or two, if you have months where they mistakenly did not generate bills during that month, you might call them and ask. Again, kind of a sort of a Hail Mary kind of an attempt there. The good news is with this expanded public service loan forgiveness waiver that's going to exist between now and the end of October of 2022, you don't have to worry about this as long as a payment was made. As long as you made any kind of payment at all, and you know you can see that clearly on your NSLDS file, then they're going to count those 2 months provided you worked full-time at a nonprofit or public sector employer. So that's the good news is, you know, anybody that had sort of unqualifying payment types that was trying to go the TE-PSLF route that was so, you know, muddied. The good news is with this waiver with PSLF, all you got to do is make sure you've submitted an accurate employer certification form with all of your payment, or all of your, I should say, employment history, like listed on there, and that you have all direct loans. And that's pretty much all you need to do to like at least get them to evaluate your payment history to get some extra credit there. So hopefully that's helpful. Okay, and now we have a question about Department of Health student loans being affected by the PSLF waiver, along with whether or not you should be consolidating with this PSLF waiver.
Hi, Travis. My name is Francis, and I am about a year out of residency and currently practicing as a hospitalist. I love your show and was hoping you could help me with a two-part question concerning the new PSLF waiver changes. My situation is that I have about $300,000 in direct loans and on track for PSLF. The problem is I never consolidated my loans, so I have a mix of direct loans and direct grad plus loans. Since I never consolidated, some loans entered repayment earlier than others due to the grace period. So my PSLF eligible loan payments are wonky and different from each other by about 6 months. If I consolidate to one loan before October 2022, what would my eligible number of payments become? The loan with the least number of payments or the most number of payments? My second question is I have a loan for disadvantaged students or LDS loan through ECSI for about $8,000 and just learned from your show that I can consolidate those into a direct consolidation loan and combine them with my other loans. Under the new PSLF waiver, would any of my payments toward that loan count? And again, how would that affect my ultimate number of already eligible payments made? Thanks, Travis.
Okay, so this is a real juicy question. Thought maybe you never want to, I guess, thought you'd hear that about student loans, right? It's so boring, right? But like, this is actually a lot going on with this question. What's being discussed here, what Francis is discussing, is you've got a bunch of direct loans with different payment histories. You know, if you consolidate those, what payment credit or what payment amount is going to be counted? Is it going to be the loan that has the most payments or the fewest? I'll tell you what I know at this point, which might change, and if it does, I'll update you on the show. But Department of Education has not released any guidance on this. This is a known issue, specifically with people with FFEL loans, FFEL loans. So, you know, the direct loans do not need to be consolidated for this PSLF opportunity. So what we're telling people is if you have direct loans and you've already made payments of any kind on them, do not consolidate those at this point. So do not consolidate those. It'll muddy the waters. It'll confuse things. leave all of your direct student loans that you have made a payment on, at least one payment, leave those alone and do not touch them except for a couple rare situations, which are not worth going into because they're very specific and I don't want to like confuse anybody. You know, so that's the baseline answer that I would give Francis is do not consolidate your direct loans that have payments on them at all, which sounds like you've made at least one payment on all of them, so don't consolidate any of it. Now, the maybe exception to the rule is these Department of Health student loans. So just so you know, there's like 17 different kinds of student loans that you can consolidate. A lot of those 17, you know, line items are loans that are actually issued by the Department of Health and Human Services. This loan program, I would guess that it like predates a lot of the direct loan stuff. I haven't looked into it carefully, but basically you have a whole separate federal loan program operated by the Department of Health that's not talking to the Department of Education at all. It doesn't apply to a huge number of people, but it applies to a lot of healthcare professionals. And since a lot of people are in healthcare in our audience, we run into it disproportionately. It's kind of extremely ironic and shows you what everything that's wrong with the student loan program, that loans that are called loans for disadvantaged students could end up screwing over disadvantaged students because people don't find out that they're eligible to be forgiven by consolidation until years after they could have consolidated them and made payments on them. How ironic, right? That a loan that's literally meant to help students that are less represented in medicine can actually become an anchor on them because they could have taken direct student loans at a higher interest rate because after public service loan forgiveness is accounted for, that interest rate is actually a negative interest rate. I don't know. Go try to make sense of federal government tax policy and stuff like that. It doesn't make any sense, right? It just is what it is, and you got to make the best decisions for yourself based on the rules. This person's got an $8,000 Health and Human Services ECSI loan. Just so you know, Heartland ECSI is the servicer for almost all of these kind of loans. So if you have a loan at Heartland ECSI, here's a PSA, that's probably a federal loan. It's probably secretly owned by the Department of Health and Human Services, and it's probably eligible for forgiveness. And you want to weigh factors of do you consolidate that and turn it into something that's forgivable, or is it just not worth it? And in the case of Francis, I think this $8,000 loan is just not worth messing with the other stuff. It's $8,000. It's very small. You know, if you have like a $1,000 loan and you're going to be in healthcare forever, then probably what I would do is take the $1,000 loan, consolidate it with the $8,000 loan because you have to have a direct loan to pair it with, and then that would turn it into a $9,000 loan. And maybe you, if you're already on something like pay as you earn, then your standard 10-year cap on the payments would be $90 a month. So maybe say you've got 5 years to go on PSLF, let's say, well, if you're making $90 a month payments after the majority of everything is forgiven because of the way the cap on the payments work, then you're paying 90 times 12 times 5, which is approximately half of the amount. But again, most people would look at that and think, oh my goodness, so you're telling me to do something for like an $800 a year benefit for 5 years that I'm just going to forget to do. So, you know, I would say that most people would not go to that trouble because it's such a small loan, right? So this gets into the nitty-gritty, though, of like what we do. A lot of people like, I don't know. I mean, some people get what we do, and then some people I feel like look down on us, like Reddit people like hate us, I guess. I don't know. A lot of them do. I think they think we're like one of the student loan scammer people, but it's sort of like, okay, so the Department of Education is going to give borrowers with like multiple different kinds of loans, like free advice, and they're going to tell them how to file their taxes the right way and maximize their 457 and 403b plans to minimize their AGI to optimize the decision between going for forgiveness or paying back their debt. And that's going to be something that's going to be provided for free. Maybe it should be provided for free, but is it going to be provided for free? I think the answer is no, just like the IRS gives free tax filing options, but that would cost you a massive amount of money if you used those free filing options if you have a complex tax situation, right? You'd hire a CPA. So I don't know. Great question. Let's move on to the next one. All right. Now we got a question from Anthony about how to figure out basically when his payment start date should be for PSLF.
Hello, this is Anthony here. Just had a few questions for you. Number one, I was wondering when it comes to the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, do you think that Federal Loan Servicing can tell me when my exact start date in the program was so I can go and find any discrepancies or see if there's any any missing information on my part or any payments that were not counted that should have been counted. As I understand it, we send in ECF forms every year. I did miss one year, but I did send in one today. Do you think that that ECF form will count for all 6.5 years that I've been with my place of employment and law enforcement? Or do I have to go in and try to send in an ECF form for every year that was missed? I hope my questions were clear enough for you, and thank you.
I love y'all's questions. They're always really good. Okay, in Anthony's case, what it sounds like is there could be some years of service that he served as law enforcement officer that FedLoan doesn't know about. So you got to think about how they're going to manage this program, like, because they're just doing this for millions of people and they have to do this with computers, right? So whatever is in the electronic stuff that they've got on the file is what they're going to go off of. What I'm really worried about is a lot of people out there like Anthony are going to have years worth of public service that FedLoan just simply doesn't know about, because the employer certification form left off that year of credit because it wasn't filled out completely. So, for example, if you know you have to pay on an income-based plan and have direct loans and be working full-time, maybe a lot of people just didn't bother submitting the employer certification forms for years that they were in the wrong repayment plan, or years that they were, you know, in and out of forbearance or something like that. So, or maybe years they made late payments. So what I'm telling everybody is, your employer certification form, make sure that you basically just kind of word vomit it, right? And put like every year that you served as a public servant on that form and update that and send that to FedLoan with basically all of your employment history on there that's relevant. The reason I'm saying that is that's the only way to make sure that you're good, because they need to know all that employment information by October 31st, 2022, because that's the cutoff date for them evaluating all this. They're going to take longer than that to evaluate all these claims, but that's when it needs to be submitted by. So that's what I would tell Anthony, is if you're missing a year on your ECF, submit that. If you have some credit for when you were a law enforcement officer before you were on an income-based plan, or before you remember when your start date was, go ahead and submit that. Because if you made any kind of payment at all on the right kind of loans, on those direct loans, they're going to count. And then if those loans were FFEL loans at the time, well, then you just, if they're still FFEL loans, you got to consolidate those. But a lot of people take those FFEL loans and consolidate them already, because that's what you have to do to get PSLF like before this announcement. So, you know, probably the majority of people, the problem they're going to have is just that they didn't tell FedLoan or whoever the new servicer is going to be about their full employment history. So make sure that doesn't happen to you. Okay, now we've got a question that I really love from Amber.
Hey, Travis. I have a pretty unique situation to run by you. My parents have recently graciously decided to pay for half of my student loans. I currently have about $294,000 in student loans. So if they are outright paying their half of about $147,000 to 150, I'll have about 147,000 remaining in federal grad plus loans. My question for you is, given that my current income is about 1.25 of that of the remaining of my balance of 147,000, would it make the most sense to refinance with a lower interest rate right now? Or should I continue with the federal loans in hopes of potentially getting some type of forgiveness with the current climate? Or I also, the job I'm currently in qualifies as a nonprofit and would qualify me for PSLF. However, I don't know if I'm going to be in this state or at this position for the next 10 years. Looking forward to hearing what your thoughts are. Thanks.
All right. I can't tell you how often I've heard of this. So you've got an aunt or an uncle or grandparent or grandma or you know, mom or dad who's just like, oh my gosh, my kid is so screwed. And unless I come in here with just like the big pile of Deus Ex Machina money just to throw at this problem, my niece, nephew, son, daughter, et cetera, grandchild is going to forever be living in an apartment with roommates, and they're never going to settle down, and they're never going to own a house, and I'm never going to have grandkids. Like, this like gets deep at like the visceral stuff that people feel, right? That families feel. And like, more specifically, like the biggest thing you ever want for your kids is just for them to be secure and okay. Like that's your deepest desire as a parent, right? And so parents have this big pot of money and then they're like, I can't pay for all of it because that would be like a huge chunk out of my retirement. But, you know, we just sold a piece of property. We have some extra money lying around and this is going to be an inheritance anyways. I would love to give this to you so that you could pay down some of your loans to make the payments affordable. And I'll tell you this. I'll say that what I would do if you had to use the money towards student loans, like if the choice was get it for student loans or not, then what you would do is probably refinance the half of the loans to a 20-year fixed rate to give yourself a low monthly payment. Because it, you know, once you paid off half of it, the income-based payment is going to be the exact same if you have the debt or not. That's not going to be any different, right? I mean, in terms of if you have all of it or half of it, the IBR payment will be the same. So that means that if your goal is to get a low payment that you can more easily afford, then you'd refinance to a 20-year fixed rate on half of it. However, in Amber's case, I would not refinance any of it. I would not allow your person that wants to pay that money towards your loans and your family to do that. And the reason I would tell you that is because if your debt to income ratio with all the debt is 2.5 to 1, there is never a scenario, unless you have hyperinflation, where it makes sense for you to pay back your loans. Now, if you make a ton of money, if you're making more than what you have in debt within 5 years, then I would take that back. I would say maybe you do need to pay back your loans. But there's uncertainty with Amber's job where maybe she will stay in a public service sector. Maybe she will leave. Maybe, I don't know, she didn't mention relationship status, but maybe she might get married or something, which could impact the payment strategy. So there are things on the table. But I would posit that the worst case scenario is student loans or an income tax. When you pay money towards student loans that could have been forgiven is sometimes just straight up wasted money, where the strategy doesn't really change. If you're a public servant with 1.25 times your income in debt, you're still going for public service loan forgiveness, in which case you just wasted, you know, a six-figure gift. So what I would argue for instead is, you know, if Amber's making good income, let's say she's making, you know, 100-something thousand, you know, yeah, the housing market is kind of nuts, right? People are coming in with cash offers and things like that, and it's still pretty crazy. But it does feel like, at least in this fall season, that the housing market is a little bit slower. It's still kind of ridiculous, but it doesn't seem like, you know, you're going to get 54 cash offers tomorrow because you just don't see it in the newspaper as much, right? What I would say instead is maybe talk to the parents about how there's uncertainty around whether or not this could be forgiven. And worst case scenario, you could still refinance this. Like you could pay it down, get it below 2 times your income in debt to income ratio, and then you could refinance it on your own 2 feet. So what I would try to convince the parents of, and who knows if this is possible, but I would try to convince them that instead they should give that to you for a huge down payment on a house to give yourself a smaller mortgage payment. So that's what I would recommend. Is you might say, well, what it sounds like you want to do is help me, you know, not have a burden on my life that's preventing me from doing other things in my life. That's what you might say. And you might say, well, okay, if I have a car payment, if I have any other kinds of payments, if I have a home equity loan, if I have a mortgage that's kind of high. I mean, if you already have a home, what would be a killer is to use that 150 grand to pay down your mortgage and then re-refinance your mortgage to a new 30-year fixed rate at like 3%, because your payment could be like half of what you're paying currently. And oh my gosh, if you cut your housing costs by half, think about how much more freedom you'll have. So I would argue for more creativity than that. The goal is they're going to take this money and help you. So I would say, like, these loan programs are extremely complicated. So somebody wants to spend $150,000 or $100,000, whatever it is, you should tell, like, the parent that I'll accept this, but only if you do, this is maybe self-interested, right? But only if you do a joint consult with Student Loan Planner. I'll pay for it. You know, I'm not saying me specifically, I'm saying, you know, because that would be pretty expensive if I had to personally pay for everyone's consult. But, you know, you get what I'm saying, right? Like, I think Amber should say, well, I'm going to pay for this consult just so that we can get a double check on if I'm missing out on any loan forgiveness before you gift me all this money. And then what will happen over the course of an hour is we can help educate the person that wants to make the gift. We get to show them the costs associated with everything. And sometimes the answer is still, you know what? No, I want to pay it. I want to be debt-free. And I respect that. If that's your opinion, that's fine. What I have an opposition to is somebody doing something without understanding the full range of options that they have. So that's what we're good at, is helping make sure somebody understands the full scope of choices that they've got available to them. And I think Amber would be much better served to use that money in a different fashion. And now a question from Brandon about repay and pay, as well as getting creative with how much PS Love credit you might be able to get.
Hi, Travis and the Student Loan Planner team. I have two questions. Number one, I'm currently set on the repay program, and I am eligible for the pay program. Now, according to Fed Loan, switching the program wouldn't alter my payments in terms of dollar amount. But my question being, does changing from repay to pay restart my 20 or 25 year forgiveness clock? My other question is regarding public service loan forgiveness. I was working in a public service loan forgiveness qualifying employer previously, but I was also getting my master's degree at the time, so I was in classes. I'm assuming and have been told that that time would not count, even though I had other loans from my undergrad that were being paid on at that time. Is that true? Thank you so much for all you do. I really appreciate it.
Thing about this is, if you look at the actual regulations and the actual law text, which you can do with Cornell's website, then you can see very clearly that pay, repay, and IBR all count for one another. So if you change off of one and you get back onto another, even if you're on the repay plan, which is a 25-year plan, that counts towards pay as you earn, which is only 20 years until forgiveness on graduate school loans. So the question I get all the time is, oh my gosh, well then why don't I do repay for 19 years? Because I'm going to get interest subsidies, and then I'm going to change over to pay at the last second. Well, first off, the Department of Education has talked a little bit at times about locking everybody into the plan they're already on if they create a new income-driven repayment plan, which would render that strategy null and void, and you could be stuck on repay and have five extra years of payments. And you guys are giving way more credit to student loan servicers in the Federal Student Aid Office than you should. So that's not a strategy that I would recommend at all. It's like switching last second. But in terms of if you're 3 years into a plan, and you know for sure that you're going for loan forgiveness over a 20, 25-year period, then yes, I would be on the pay plan, because pay is the exact same payments as repay with some added features like a cap on the payments, ability to file taxes separately, et cetera. Only exception to that is sometimes repay can be very useful if you have a spouse that also has debt. Super complicated. We call it the double debt loophole, where there's one spouse on pay, one spouse on repay. You're filing separately, doing proportional payment election on repay, and filing separately on pay as you earn to get the lowest payment. If that confused you, then don't worry about it. But if you have two spouses that one has a wildly different debt to income ratio than the other one does, then if you haven't consulted us, you should, because it gets complicated. The question about, you know, can you get PS Love credit while you were in school? If you have loans from a prior program, they give you in-school deferment, and you might be taking out additional loans. So what you can do is do an in-school deferment waiver request and keep your payments going on loans that are not for the program that you're currently enrolled for. So we do this sometimes with mixed success for dental residents. So maybe an orthodontist is in a type of, like, let's say an orthodontist is in an orthodontics residency program, and they've got $200,000-$300,000 of dental school loans. They know they're eventually going to refinance them. Well, maybe they need a little bit of loans for orthodontic residency program. Maybe they're using savings. And so what you can do is do an in-school deferment waiver request on the $200,000 that's from dental school because it's from a different program. Do the repay plan and get half of your interest subsidized because your payments are probably close to zero. That's not guaranteed to work, but it often does work. Right now, it's an irrelevant strategy because payments are and interest are zero anyway. But there, all these things, when everything gets turned on again, all these things are suddenly going to become relevant again. So what I would tell Brandon is that if you have payments that you made on loans while working full-time at a qualifying employer, even if you're enrolled in school, then those will count. Those should count. But you have to have been making payments and not having that set up in in-school deferment, which is the default method that the Department of Education uses. So I would say it probably 95% of the time, those loans are going to be left in in-school deferment while you're enrolled, even if you're working. And the off chance that you are making payments and you can see that in your NSLDS, then yeah, probably should count if you are otherwise qualifying, because PSLF is loan-based, not borrower-based. Okay, now last question is from Mike on if he's missing out on any loopholes with his PSLF waiver.
Hi, my name is Mike from Los Angeles. I have about $200,000 in student loans, and I'm excited about this limited PSLF waiver. My question is, I have one smaller loan that's a consolidated loan from when I was in college in 2007. That's a bigger part of my Direct Plus loans that I took out for graduate school. So through these new waiver actions, I was wondering if I'm able to consolidate all my direct loans into one large loan so that the payments I made for the 2 years I worked at a nonprofit after college would count with the payments that I've made on my current loan. So just checking about that, basically I have $14,000 of that $200,000 is from my college loans. And I worked for 2 years and paid on that at a nonprofit. And then I took out more loans for graduate school and I'm 8 years into paying on those. So those are going to be on different timelines. So I didn't know if I could find some loophole to consolidate them all together so that the payments I made on the smaller portion count towards payments on the bigger portion, or if just one of my loans would be forgiven earlier and the rest would stay the same. So that's my question. Again, this is Mike from Los Angeles.
So I just want to say that I love how you guys think. Like, this is so great. I'm so proud. And in terms of the answer to the question is that, again, we're awaiting guidance on this. So if I like try to game this out, then I'm sort of thinking, well, some people will hear consolidation as part of the solution without listening to say that it's only for FFEL loans that you would consolidate for. And they're going to consolidate all their direct loans because of this. So at least a couple people are going to do that, right? And maybe they shouldn't have done that. And so then Department of Education is going to have to make a decision, like what qualifying payment credit do we put on these loans? Do we put, you know, the minimum? So in other words, whatever had the least, fewest number of qualifying payments, we're going to put it on that, or do we use the most? I would just guess that in situations where people consolidate, this is just a wild guess. Well, we'll update you when Department of Education has guidance. But if I had to guess, then I would say that they would probably use the loans that you have the fewest months of credit on rather than loans that have the most months of credit on. Why do I think that? It's because they left out Parent Plus loans from this order completely, which makes me think that they don't want it to be a political liability for them. They want it to only be this positive thing where we're talking about fixing it for nurses and firefighters and military members, and they don't want this to become a, you know, hey, look at this, a bunch of rich doctors are getting years of extra credit that they didn't even qualify for. That's what they probably want to avoid. And so if I'm just guessing, that's how I think it'll go, is that they'll probably treat it with the FFEL loans. Well, you have to consolidate those. And so should you consolidate only a couple of them? I mean, you know, I think it's TBD on that. If I were you, if I had any FFEL loans, if I was a public servant, I wouldn't worry about the fact that they might have slightly different months of credit. I would just consolidate them all together and just see what happens, because it's more credit than you would have had anyway, right? So, and plus, if you try to do separate consolidations, it can be really confusing, and they're probably going to roll other consolidations into your current consolidation online. They might do that anyway. Are we really going to see this mass paper application strategy to get maximize your credit with this temporary public service waiver? I don't think so. I don't think that's what they want. I don't think that the servicers are set up to handle something like that. But certainly if there's an opportunity to do so, you're going to know about it. So thank you, everyone. That's all the questions that we're going to answer for today's episode. If you loved how I answered these questions and you have one of your own, you can go to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail and press the record button on your mobile phone and say your 30-second to minute question, and then if we think it's a good one, we'll feature it on the show. So now I wanted to talk about the main topic that I've got for today, which is Navient firing themselves. I was stuck in this are they or aren't they kind of situation with Navient, because they came to an agreement with the Biden administration to do a 2-year extension of their contract, and then they came out right after they agreed to that and said that we want to not do it anymore. So it's like, what? Like, what are you even talking about? Now they just announced that they're switching everything over to a company called Maximus, but it's actually to their subsidiary, which is called Aid Vantage. So if you're a Navient borrower right now, everything except for the FFEL loans at Navient and the private student loans at Navient is going to get moved to Aid Vantage. So a couple quick thoughts on this. So the reason why Navient agreed to the contract terms before announcing this, I think, is because the goal, I think, is to have the new company take over the contract. In other words, assume the responsibilities of the contract. And there's not a guarantee that the Department of Education was going to approve it. So I think Navient wanted to negotiate it first and then try to see if they could come to an agreement with the Department of Education to transfer the contract second. So this is Navient making a business decision. So Navient only gets about 6% of its revenue from student loan servicing. That's a pittance. That's a tiny amount of revenue to get, you know, from a business line that you are known for, right? And, you know, there's all kinds of extra scrutiny and enforcement actions against them. I'm not saying it's not deserved. It probably is, right? But the issue with that is, from a business perspective, it does not make sense to have a ton of negative press attention and a ton of lawsuits and compliance actions and responding to all these things. They probably realized that they were losing money on it, or at least having a liability on their brand from having it around. So that's why I think Navient punted this. And that's why FedLoan punted this, is Navient and FedLoan, I think, did not do a great job servicing federal student loans for a variety of reasons. And they're looking at their portfolio of things that they can do with their resources. And they just said, you know what? My dad likes to say that he juices a lot of oranges with his orange trees. He says, the juice ain't worth the squeeze. So I think that's kind of what they determined in getting out of the federal student loan servicing business. So what is Aidvantage and what does this mean? So Maximus is the company that manages student loan defaults for the federal government currently. That's not good news. This is a company that predominantly is used to collecting loans for people in deep economic distress. This is a company that I wouldn't say that the federal government should be excited about how they've managed defaults. So why would you give them more business? My guess is because of the companies that submitted proposals, probably Aidvantage submitted a proposal because they know how to manage call centers for a low cost. The government's not willing to pay very much money for these companies to manage the call centers, and therefore you're going to attract the bids that you're going to attract. It's very telling that Maximus, instead of servicing the loans under the name Maximus, what they're doing is servicing the loans under a subsidiary called Aidvantage. Why is that? Well, if you have a more activist government that's going to be filing compliance suits and allowing state-level lawsuits against you, then what you want to do is carve out a subsidiary of your business that can get the revenue, send it up the chain, so to speak, and then absorb all the lawsuits. If they need to shut it down, they can easily. So it's a repeat of the FedLoan situation, where FedLoan is a subsidiary of a company called FHIA, Pennsylvania Higher Education Authority, that, you know, used FedLoan to not sully their brand as well as absorb all the negative attention that they're getting on student loan servicing. So my guess is that Aidvantage, this is just a guess, I think they're going to be worse than Navient. I think they're going to have an even harder time managing things, and I think it's going to be messy. I don't think that needs to bother anyone that listens to this podcast, because I think that you will be okay no matter what. And I think that, you know, if you got a plan from us, that plan's not going to change just because your servicer is a little bit more clueless. So that's just my opinion about how things go. We will see what happens. In terms of the FedLoan situation, right now it seems like FedLoan might be in a situation where they're going to be transferring their borrower accounts to more servicers than we previously thought. So maybe your loans at FedLoan will transfer to not just Mohela, but maybe Nelnet, maybe Great Lakes. It's TBD at this point. So don't be alarmed by the FedLoan stuff. We do expect that transfer is going to happen by the holidays. So pre-Christmas, I think we're going to have the FedLoan company be out of the business because their contract expires. Don't quote me on this, but I think it's around December 19th, or it's something in the teens of December is when their contract expires. So we'll see that, you know, we could always see a temporary, you know, expansion of that contract for another couple weeks or something if they needed to through the holidays. But I would expect they'll be gone by that point. That's all I've got for you at this point. We're going to have a lot more information for you as the student loan landscape develops with this really chaotic restart of payments. I will say I'm seeing crazy stuff that I never thought I'd see before. The Department of Education is bidding on a bunch of student loan related terms in Google search now, which is, I don't know, that's interesting. We're seeing aggressive outreach campaigns. So I'll tell you this, the Department of Education would not be bidding on Google search terms about how to get an affordable payment right now if they did not anticipate a wave of questions people have with restarted payments, and if they were not planning on restarting payments January 31st of 2022. So that is virtually a surefire thing with all the things that I'm seeing the Department of Education do to get borrowers ready to go back into repayment. So expect that's definitely going to happen. And, you know, if you want to get a student loan plan, you can book that around 60 days to 90 days ahead of time. I would recommend doing that if you want to have control over when the plan happens. I think I haven't checked today, but I have either two appointments for the rest of the year or zero. I probably have zero if I looked, and my January calendar is almost full. We're having this issue with other consultants as well. It's the great labor shortage of 2021, I guess. Doing the best I can, I hired two additional consultants and have sort of been trying to hang on to a team that's large enough to service most of the need that I expect we'll have when payments restart. But then we've had all these sort of extensions of the payment pause. And so I have no idea if we're going to be adequately staffed come January. So the payment strategy doesn't really change with the restart of payments. So if you want to get a plan ahead of the mad rush where you're going to get more attention and more focus from us, I would say go ahead and reserve a spot ahead of time that you can change if you need to, because we don't actually require a credit card up front to hold the spot. So that's studentloanplanner.com/book. And also, interest rates are seemingly starting to go up. So if you need to refinance your federal student loans or your private student loans, go to studentloanplanner.com/refi. I'm Travis with Student Loan Planner. Thank you for listening, y'all. Until next week.